3 weeks ago, researchers at the University of Southern California reported the results of an 18-year study on human eating habits. They found that consuming high levels of protein, particularly animal protein, is a bad strategy if you're in midlife and hoping to live into old age. Middle-aged Americans who had the highest consumption of protein were more than 4 times as likely to die of cancer or diabetes, and twice as likely to die of any cause than those whose diets were lowest in protein. At the same time, research reveals that in older age, fortifying your diet with more protein-rich foods might be a formula for living longer. A look at the research and conflicting claims of the value of high-protein diets, next on Midday. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Earlier this month, a 2-decade-long nutritional study conducted by researchers at the University of Southern California's Longevity Institute linked high animal protein intake to an increased cancer risk for people under the age of 65. Walter Longo, the director of the study, went on to compare the health risks of a meat-heavy diet to that of smoking. This comparison gained a lot of media attention, as high-protein dieting fads, such as the Atkins and Paleolithic diets, are commonly used as a weight loss tactic. But the study also, some might say confusingly, encourages increased protein intake for the elderly, claiming that such a diet can delay the effects of aging in senior citizens. This type of news is nothing new for the health-conscious and the media savvy. It seems every few months, a new study arrives demonizing something from your pantry, whether it's fats, trans fats, carbohydrates, gluten, eggs, butter, sugar, sugar substitutes, salt, oil, or preservatives. But this seems particularly true of high-protein diets, which have been the subject of conflicting claims over the last several years. So we thought it was time to have a conversation about this and unravel it a bit. To help us parse it out, to commemorate National Nutrition Month, too, we're joined by two nutrition experts today. Dr. Gerard Mullen is an associate professor of medicine and director of integrative gastroenterology nutrition services at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of 5 books about nutrition and digestive health. The Inside Tract is his 2011 book, The Inside Tract, Your Good Gut Guide to Great Digestive Health. So, Dr. Mullen, it's nice to have you back on the show, I should say, for joining us again here on Midday. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Same here. Thank you.
And we're also joined on the phone by Angela Ginn-Meadow. Angela has been on our show before. We haven't had her on for a while. It was time we got her back. She's a food and nutrition expert, spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Angela, nice to have you on the show again.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be back.
I want to spend a few minutes with Dr. Mullen at the outset, though, talking about this this study. And you had a chance to look at it. It was published in Cell Metabolism. That's the journal, right?
Yes, a prominent journal.
All right. I've just sort of described briefly the main findings of it. So why don't you give us a little bit more what you read from the, and take from the report?
Well, it's a large study from a National Health Nutrition Survey of over 6,000 subjects over a long period of time.
18 years, right?
Yeah.
18 years.
And their initial focus was to look at diabetes mortality and the effect of diet, in particular, high-protein diet, because many of these individuals are counseled to cut down on their carbs, so the substitution would be either fats or protein, and naturally, the low-hanging fruit would be to look at the protein. And so that was the question. And so they're in looking at all-cause mortality, cancer-related mortality over a long period of time, they parsed it out into 2 age groups. Those who are 50 to 65, and then those over 65, didn't provide much of a rationale as to why they did that, but the data were very much in contrast in that, as you described, those who are in the more middle-aged group had higher mortality, all-cause mortality, and cancer mortality with what they defined as a higher protein diet, meaning more than, let's say, 20% of their diet from protein.
You said all causes.
So all causes.
So not just cancer, all causes.
All causes. So So what we're looking at is in that age group, protein, high protein could be a bad thing. Now, what we didn't discuss yet is the fact that it may have a differential effect based on the type of protein. So that if you are a vegetarian and you have more vegan sources of protein, this would not apply to you in that age group of, 50 to 65,
mm-hmm.
Which really will raise an interesting discussion point today about what's in our food. And what in our food can cause a differential effect as observed by these investigators. So the other, on the flip side, was the over 65 group. And in those who were of that age, they found that they actually had a reverse effect in that if they were on a low protein, instead of being protective, it enhanced the all-cause mortality and the cancer-related mortality. Which is somewhat confusing. Why is there a differential effect now?
Hmm.
One could spin that in such a way that that with aging, we get a condition called sarcopenia, where that we start to replace our muscle mass with fat, we become more immobile, illness intervenes, and our immune system resistance becomes lower. So therefore, having protein is much more valuable to us to maintain all those physiological functions. And thus, the individuals who are on a lower protein diet would have a worse outcome for all those reasons. That I could certainly logically argue. But in the flip side, why, we know that and certainly we'll talk more about the sub-studies that were done on hormones that may relate to cancer growth. For example, growth hormone and insulin growth factor are trophic, or they enhance the proliferation of cells. So if your cells are susceptible or programmed towards cancer, if you have the right gene or right hit at the right time, and you have higher levels of these trophic hormones, that could cause those individuals on a higher protein diet, and higher protein diets can drive the insulin trophic response in the body.
I just want to understand the connection to proteins.
Yeah, proteins. Well, it appears to differ amongst the different types of proteins how well they stimulate the production of these hormones.
Okay.
And these hormones, in turn, stimulate cell proliferation. And therefore, if you are of the right genetic and environmental predisposition, those high levels of hormones can cause those cancer cells to proliferate. And that's the theory that they kind of went through the paper and then did parallel experiments on mice, which we kind of knew about already, that if you give a mouse that already has susceptibility to breast cancer or melanoma, if you have high levels of IGF or growth hormone, they will be more susceptible to cancer. We know that data already, so that I don't see as being new in the paper. But the point they were making was that the patients who were middle-aged, 50 to 65, had higher levels of these hormones, in particular who were having animal sources of protein, and they were the ones at the higher risk of going on to develop cancer.
Right.
So they kind of linked all these mm-hmm. data together and mm-hmm. said, but,
But again, it relates to animal proteins, right?
Yes, and that, well, at the...
Where the increased risk was found.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. In other words, they could negate the effect that their finding of the cancer and all-cause mortality was negated or attenuated in those who had vegan sources of protein.
Hmm. Interesting. I want to ask Angela Ginmeadow for her comments on this now. Angie works a lot with people with diabetes, right? You've been a consultant to folks who struggle with diabetes. So I wonder, going back to the beginning here of our conversation about high-protein diets, did you see a lot of people are at least asking you about going to a high-protein diet to reduce their carb intake?
Well, that is usually common when people are especially first diagnosed with diabetes. As a diabetes educator, I'm really there to help people to have a balance. And I say, your brain needs carbohydrates. We're not going to just completely wipe mm-hmm. out carbs, but we rethink the plate. When I say that is, hey, your protein is still small. It's only a quarter of your plate. And you still consume carbohydrates, but you consume the right ones. And we do know with a high-risk population of people having diabetes that can have complications to diabetes, one being kidney failure, We are very cautious of what type of protein, how much you're eating, and also making sure that you consume lean meat most of the time.
And what did you think of this report? Does this surprise you, Angie?
Well, you know, this has been a battle, I would say, over years. We just can't quite get it right. But I do know that the studies that have been done on individuals that have a vegetarian or have a vegan lifestyle, we do know that they lower the risk factors of certain diseases. So that always gives me a little light bulb go off. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is they're consuming more vegetable-based protein than anything. And if that works for them, hey, this may be something that we all need to do more of, really thinking about how much meat we really are consuming, especially high-fat meat.
I'm going to say this about the Atkins diet, which was a fad several years ago. And actually, I realized from my reading prior to the show today that Atkins' research goes back to the 1950s, a paper he published in the late 50s. And then he developed these diets in the 70s, and they got to be really hot in the 90s, right? And I remember a lot of people took it as, it's okay now to eat bacon and pork rinds, right? No, I mean, I'm seriously, that's how a lot of people took it. So, okay, I shouldn't eat as much bread and spaghetti and cut back on the pizza.
Right.
But he's saying, okay, have a salad, but it's okay to eat steaks. It's okay to eat bacon and pork rinds. That's how a lot of people interpreted that idea. Is that unfair to Atkins? First of all, is that an unfair characterization of the diet? I'll ask you, Dr. Mullen, of the diet that he described.
I don't know how fair it is, quite honestly, because I know a lot of people who interpret it that way and were counseled to do that mistakenly, and then certainly clogged their coronaries in the process. So that was not the best way to do that. And on the flip side, another diet called the Zone diet that has more of a proportional balance of carbs, fats, and proteins. People mistakenly thought that if you have a cheeseburger, that would certainly balance the fats and the carbs and the proteins all in one and fell swoop.
Yeah.
So you could twist the diet any way you want to put junk in. But
it's no joke, actually. A lot of people interpreted it that.
Yeah,
that
but
way.
The intention,
right.
That was not the intention
right.
of Atkins. But unfortunately, many people perpetuated that myth over a long period of time. And then the last time we were on the show together was the Dukan diet, which is the French twist to the Atkins diet with a very clever marketing spin, which was very similar. Except for the taking the stairs and the movement and the every seventh day break. And
remember that
there were some very clever aspects to it, which led to millions of books, you know, internationally with the French paradox as a marketing spin. But it was really the Atkins diet. So he really revolutionized, this high protein, low carb approach that many people adopt today.
Angie, when someone uses that term, Atkins diet, someone who's come to you for some help with their diabetes or whatever it is, general health, losing weight. What is your reaction? What is your general advice?
So I take a step back because this means if someone wants to follow a diet, I need to really ask them why. And I ask them, well, how long do you think you can follow this? Does this contain all the food groups that will be healthy for you? And you know what? If you really want to follow it, we're going to tweak it a little bit. And, you know, if we fast forward a little bit more beyond Atkins, a paleo diet is another one that's kind of similar, but it really talks about, you know, that people are eating higher protein, high fiber this time around. But I can have people eat fish as a lean form and have some vegetables along with it. It doesn't have to be bacon. It doesn't have to be a high-fat steak, but it's really rethinking your plate. And having half a plate of fruits and veggies or veggies alone with a lean protein, I think that's where we really need to move people toward.
Angela Ginn-Meadow will be with us for the hour on the phone, a food and nutrition expert, spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And Dr. Gerard Mullen is with us. FoodMD is his website. You can find a link to it. He's a digestive health expert from Johns Hopkins University and author of The Inside Tract, Your Good Gut Guide to Great Digestive Health, which I believe was published 2011, right, Dr. Mullen?
Dale Press.
Very good. All right, we're going to talk some more about this. Have you been on a high-protein diet? Did you try the paleo? We'd like to hear from you if you have questions about it. And please tell us about your experience. 410 662 8780, the midday email address. You can write a question or comment that way. Describe a diet you went on. Please be brief. midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. We welcome your calls and questions for our guest, Dr. Gerard Marlin, visiting us today from Johns Hopkins Hospital. And on the phone, Angela Ginmeadow, nutritionist, who's been on our show before, as has Dr. Marlin. 410-662-8780. Question about the Paleolithic diet. Now, this one has been around for quite some time. It seems to have gone through a resurgence or a revival in recent years.
A little renaissance. Huh?
A little renaissance.
Yeah.
There's something about it that's always bugged me a little bit.
What's that?
The Paleolithic diet consists mainly of fish, grass-fed, pasture-raised meats, eggs, vegetables, fruit, fungi, root vegetables, and nuts. Okay, does that about cover it?
Yeah, sounds about right. We're in a more of a grain-free mode with that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, it excludes grains.
Yeah.
The part that I never understood, it excludes legumes, too, which is basically means beans, right?
It is what it
is. To me, it means beans, lentils, things that seem kind of healthy to me.
Yeah.
So is that done just to make it, does that make it, and it excludes dairy, right, and refined sugars, of course. But does that, leaving out the legumes, to me, I have a problem with it. I didn't understand that. I had my daughter wanted to do this diet and actually did it and said, no beans. And I didn't quite understand why that was left out. Is that to be historically accurate or something about the way the paleos lived? Or
the hunter-gatherers were not bean eaters. You're from a bean town, I guess,
in Boston. Boston area.
And my mother, being Italian, raised me to eat beans.
But
I'm sure Angela recommends that for her diabetics and her patients.
I do. I recommend it for anybody. Fiber is life's broom. So beans and lentils really can get rid of all the extra gunk. And it's important that we consume them on a regular basis. And we do know that beans have been shown to lower the risk of certain cancers, too.
Doesn't that involve some protein as well? Isn't that a good source of protein?
And also, it's not the richest source of protein, but it really feeds the good, healthy bacteria. They're prebiotic, right? Because it breaks down the fiber, the soluble fibers, in the beans, and in turn, that's going to feed the good, healthy bacteria that's going to keep us going. And in fact, you need that. You need a certain balance of fiber to really keep yourself moving, but also to keep those bacteria growing. And we're finding so many things today that the role for those bacteria really are the control panel for our overall health. That we're just, it's like Rodney Dangerfield would say, no respect.
Right.
You know, that the heart is romantic, the brain is sexy. I mean, you hear all, but the gut, it gets no respect. But there it's the control panel. And those bacteria are symbiotic with us, and they outnumber us tenfold to one. And they actually, we have to feed them properly. So the things we're talking about cutting out, like the beans, are very necessary for their growth and the soluble fibers, and you get that from a variety of sources.
So, Angie, if you had a client wanted to do the Paleolithic diet, you might tweak that a little bit and say, okay on the legumes, okay on the beans.
Yes, I definitely would. I would include it. I'm not about exclusion. So diets oftentimes exclude food groups. Mm. We do know that refined sugar, we know salt, oils, saturated fats, we know those are bad for us. But it's all about the things that can give us health benefits. So I would encourage them to consume lentils or beans in that diet.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you have a question or comment for our guests, that was Angela Ginmeadow, who's a nutritionist on the phone with us. And in the studio with me is Dr. Gerard Marlin, visiting from Johns Hopkins University, Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of the Integrative Gastroenterology Nutrition Services at JH Hospital. Cindy in Baltimore, we'll start with you. Cindy, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share with you my experience doing a Paleolithic type of diet with my husband, known as the Primal Blueprint. It's based on a book by Mark Sisson. In 2010, my husband suffered a mild traumatic brain injury when he hit his head. He had a concussion and suffered just unbelievable memory loss. And I went looking for a solution to help him heal from that. and came across the Paleolithic diet. And in doing that diet, it improved our health so immensely. It improved my husband's memory to the point that it's better than it ever was before. I lost 50 pounds. He lost 40 pounds. All of our lab work, all of our blood markers improved greatly. He was on cholesterol meds. He's off of those now. Our CRP and inflammation markers went down. Hmm. It has completely changed our lives.
Cindy,
in every way.
Cindy,
every health
yeah.
issue we had is improved, including digestive issues and like long-standing kind of chronic irritating health issues are gone.
Cindy, just describe a couple of meals for us. Would you describe a day of meals in your house?
Sure. First of all, we're all organic, and so we eat organic eggs. Usually we'll make organic eggs with salsa for like an omelet in the morning. Occasionally we'll have an organic breakfast meat like a sausage or a bacon, but we're not, you know, crazy Atkins bacon eater people. For lunch, I'll generally have a huge salad with a lot of vegetables, including broccoli and things like that, and a source of lean protein like an organic chicken breast. And then for dinner, we will occasionally have grass-fed beef, and we'll have a lot of greens. I eat probably more kale and leafy dark green vegetables than I ever have in my whole life. We have occasional fruit and some dark chocolate, some nuts once in a while. But this truly changed our lives.
And you're sticking with it?
Yes, and we've been on it now for 2 years. And like I said, I don't want to say my age on the radio, but I'm a middle-aged woman. Got to the point where I definitely had the midsection expanding. I lost 11 inches off of my midsection by eating in this way, a diet that would blow up a Weight Watchers points calculator. I had people asking me if I had gastric bypass surgery because the weight just melted off, along with all of the health issues we had and my husband's concussion injury healing just completely.
Wow. I'm interested in that part of it, too. But just generally, thank you very much, Cindy, for this conversation and description of your family's meals. Those seem like pretty healthy eating habits to me, Dr. Mullen.
Yes, I just a few comments on from what Cindy described. One, there's a new book out, not so new, out since September. It's been a number one New York Times bestseller called Grain Brain by a good friend of mine, David Perlmutter, who's a internationally recognized neurologist out of Coral Gables and Naples. And he and I and another immunologist are putting together a journal called Brain and Gut because of the intertwining between the brain and the gut. And so what you're describing as eliminating some maybe sensitivities to grains and improving your overall condition and maybe his memory, there's been linkages with certain grains and cognition through the gut, through the gut-brain axis. And also with the losing of weight, I guess many of you are familiar with Bill Davis's book, Wheat Belly, where a lot of individuals, he's a cardiologist out in Wisconsin, he put a lot of individuals on wheat-free, gluten-free diets, and all of a sudden they started losing weight and their cardiovascular markers improved. But again, a lot of these people were doing the high refined carbs, they were stimulating a lot of insulin, and that was the basis for their cardiovascular ills. And therefore, they started losing weight once they went on sensible carbohydrate meals. And David and Bill have people who are really grain restricted, which does put people, you're going to lose weight that way, the way we eat today in America. Mm-hmm. But, you know, grains do have thiamine. They're enriched with, a number of different B vitamins that we need. They certainly have the fibers that Angie and I are talking about that you need to feed your gut. So, they are, you know, part of the plate that Angie talks about, my plate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we overdo it, and we just we give ourselves the refined flours that stimulate insulin and put us into ill health. And I think it's all about balance, as, we've all been talking about today.
Angie, your comments on Cindy's story.
Well, I wanted to congratulate her. You know, it seems like it's been such success. And the one thing that we have to keep in mind, they were consuming fruits and veggies, and special vegetables. Vegetables really were the base. and they were consuming lean proteins. So when we are thinking about making a diet choice, if lean protein is on there and the influence of more vegetables, guess what? We can change some clinical outcomes right by making those changes in our life. And, you know, from the eggs to the chicken breast to having more greens, thinking about half your plate, and even just fill up half your plate with your veggies at least twice a day would be an accomplishment for most Americans, I would say.
Yeah. Here's another call on midday for our guest, Nick in Baltimore. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Go right ahead.
So my question was on these epidemiologic studies. And the small amount of epidemiology that I've done, you know, association is not causation, especially for these retrospective studies. I was wondering if there's any prospective, I know it's hard to randomize diets, besides the DASH diet, I was wondering if there's any other studies showing prospective benefit in a randomized nature. Thanks.
Do you understand his question, Dr. Mullen?
Well, for this kind of study, has not been done in a prospective manner.
Meaning what? This is an 18-year study with 6,000
Yeah, this is more going back and saying what happened in this group of people, and they've collected serum, they've collected, you know, dietary histories.
It's not experimental.
Yeah, this is like the largest study that's been done in this country to date.
Well, I was
going to
ask
backwards,
you, is that impressive to you, the number of participants in that study? And
6,000? Yeah, that's quite impressive.
And the period of time is 18 years.
That's also quite impressive.
Yeah. Okay, so that's not the kind of study Nick had in mind.
But more that tends to be, well, it's hard to do this kind of study prospective.
Yeah.
18 years.
I mean,
what we would normally see in the literature, maybe, you know, weeks, 12 weeks, 6 months, maybe a year at best. You know, looking at different outcomes, people drop off, and dietary histories are kind of, you know, very difficult to tease out at times too.
And you got to have a grant to sustain.
Yeah, someone's got to fund it without a bias, right?
Yes,
right.
And I was going to say, even nutrition studies, we can't force people not to eat. So, when we're looking at studies where, you know, we're looking at protein or we're looking at carbohydrates, it's really hard to get participants to say, I want you to follow this, and I want you to follow it to a T, and for to have a group that didn't eat at all. So we oftentimes use, you know, looking backwards to really see long-term effects of certain things.
Angie and Dr. Mullen, let's take another call. This is Barbara in Baltimore. You're on midday. Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Hi to your guest also.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't mean to be a naysayer, but obviously 16 years or 18 years that you've been studying this, it's much better than when my doctor put me on it in the late 60s. I was told I had to eat protein 3 times a day, possibly because I would be pre-diabetic because my grandmother was a diabetic. It is skipping every other generation. And that's all I was told, just to eat protein 3 times a day. And within a couple of weeks, my breath smelled terrible. I felt terrible. And I thought, I'm not going to do this. And when I went back and I told him I wasn't going to do it, and he said that was my choice. So, but what you all are saying seems very positive.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, that study indicates that when you're consuming animal proteins is as important as how much you consume, or right, Dr. Mullen? I mean, it's talking about people. The group they looked at again was 55 to 65, which to a lot of men, women maybe too, there's a prime meat eating years, and maybe you shouldn't be eating as much animal protein during that time.
That's the whole question.
Right?
Yeah, the whole question is animal versus vegetable protein.
Right.
And what's in our animal protein nowadays? You're looking at antibiotics, hormones. You're looking at a whole gamish of things that may not be so healthy for us.
And when we're talking about vegetable proteins or vegetables as a source of protein, Angela, folks listening saying, I thought protein was cheese and milk and chicken breast and steak.
Well, you can find it in soy, beans and lentils. Also, quinoa is a source of protein. I always think about fish and seafood, you know, that's also rich in omega-3 fatty acids. And, you know, if we even look at Mediterranean diet, some of these diets, they put fish to the you know, one of the things that they consume more often, versus having some of the farm-raised animals. So think about, just rethink your plate and think about moderation. You know, I think that's the biggest key, because it's a big question mark of how much to consume. Just be really, think about moderation and how often you consume high-fat protein sources.
You know what Barbara was saying about sources of protein, 3 sources of protein a day? That doesn't seem so far-fetched to me if it's mixed in with other things like vegetables and fruits.
Yeah, and also I think what I'm hearing is that having 3 servings a day of the protein, which makes sense that we have some balance, that you don't just have all carb and bagel and in the morning with jam, and you know, you want to balance out the proteins with the carbs, which is what I think Barry Sears in the Zone Diet tried to say. And that what type of carbs? I mean, you know, you not to have refined flours as well. And I agree with Angie. I think that the fishes should be at the top of your protein source. They're very satiating, and also, I mean, very filling. And they also have many associations with protection against cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and their complications and outcomes, even with protection against cancer mortality. So, you know, those fish oils are very important for our health to fight inflammation, which is a common denominator for a lot of diseases.
3 weeks ago, researchers at the University of Southern California reported the results of an 18-year study on human eating habits. They found that consuming high levels of protein, particularly animal protein, is a bad strategy if you're in midlife and hoping to live into old age. Middle-aged Americans who had the highest consumption of protein were more than 4 times as likely to die of cancer or diabetes and twice as likely to die of any cause than those whose diets were lowest in protein. And at the same time, the research revealed that in older age, fortifying your diet with more protein-rich foods might be a formula for living longer. That's what we're discussing in this hour of our show. Our guest is Dr. Gerard Mullen from Johns Hopkins and Angela Ginn-Meadow, food and nutrition expert, with us by phone. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. A short break. We'll be right back. Joseph writing in by email to say, I am pushing 60. Through this life, I have heard all sorts of nutrition advice, and most of it is conflicting. How can I trust them now? Or is it going to end up like the Woody Allen film where everything that we thought was bad for you is really good for you? I mean, this is a, you know.
Except sugar.
Every
study.
Yeah.
That,
and salt?
Fructose.
What about salt?
Salt, too.
Yeah.
You know, too much salt is not good for you. And good luck getting a nice bowl of soup that's not so high in sodium these days.
Or fast food. Today we're talking specifically about this idea of the high protein diet, which is, I guess, it was a fad. It works for some people, but it can't be that diet we talked about earlier, people taking it as an excuse to eat lots of bacon and pork rinds, remember?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we're talking about better sources of protein, balanced with the things that we've been told all through life that need to be in the diet or on Angie's plate. Right, Angie?
Yes, exactly.
Angie's plate.
You know, the one thing I think listeners need to think about, protein we know is essential nutrient for building muscles and preparing cells in their body. But portion size really does matter. Mm. So even in thinking about when you see a computer mouse, that's about 3 ounces. And if we get a steak out or even chicken out, we may see really ginormous pieces of meat. That may be 2 to 3 portion sizes at one setting.
Mm, yeah.
So I think we really need to think about, you know, looking at the palm of our hand, making sure that it's lean, and making sure it's prepared healthy, not fried.
Mm. Here's Ed in Cockeysville joining our conversation with a question. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Dan. My question is very personal. I'm 58 years old, and I have a son with a traumatic brain injury that I have to take care of for many years now. I'm a type 2 diabetic, controlled with medication, but I don't eat vegetables. I am a philosophical vegetarian. I think it's the right way to live, but can't seem to do it. I need to know if there's something very specific way to get over an abhorrence to vegetables someplace in Baltimore.
Wow, Ed. Boy, that's really interesting. Angie, you want to try that one?
Well, I always say the vegetables we may not like when we were kids, we may enjoy them a little bit differently as adults. So, for example, I did not like Brussels sprouts when I was little. But now if I roast them or I just steam them, I enjoy them. Same with asparagus. I didn't like them boiled. But now that I can roast them or grill them, I really enjoy them. I always say add vegetables in places you least expect it, too. So some of the dishes you may enjoy, like maybe having chili, having some extra vegetables into chili, or having lettuce and tomato on a breakfast sandwich in the morning. But find key ways that you say, well, you know what, I can try vegetables in different ways. And some people are all about the smoothies now, too, from spinach to kale, making kale chips. There are tons of ways to try to enjoy vegetables in a new way.
Dr. Mullen's in here nodding. He's smiling at what you're saying about smoothies and, and kale chips, too. I discovered kale chips a few years ago, and it's fun to eat, and it's kale. The other thing, I like Angie's idea of sneaking the vegetables into various dishes. Omelet is another place where you could do it. And our first caller, Carol, mentioned salsa, eggs with the salsa.
Correct,
if you eat a salsa, you're eating vegetables. I wanted to ask Ed about, you know, what his struggle is with vegetables. Some people just can't. Angie, you've met people who just can't get them down?
I've met people that never eaten a fruit or vegetable in their life.
And is it just the habit of not eating it, or do they actually physically have a problem? Do they gag when they try to eat it? What is
it? Well, I think it's just reintroducing it in a different way. And I believe I actually served this edamame salad to women and men that were over 70. Now, they've never had an edamame in their life.
Right.
But I mixed it with some other vegetables that they were familiar with, and they were like, this is absolutely delicious. So I think it's just finding ways to incorporate, you know, some of the old things. I throw beans into, you know, sloppy joes, and my son doesn't know any difference.
Right.
So
right.
It's just really finding new ways to incorporate some vegetables.
If you're going to make a really fine lasagna, have at least one layer of spinach in there. What's wrong
with
that?
Why not? That's how
why
I
not?
Make my lasagna.
There you go.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. John in Baltimore, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead,
okay.
John. Hi.
I'm a 75-year-old. I started paleo diet in August of 2011 when I found that my gut was expanding and I was weighed at 155 pounds and I never weighed that much in my life. I had read about the paleo diet and decided to adopt it. I started tracking my calories and all that on FitDay website. I was eating 60% of my calories in fat, hardly any carbs. I lost 30 pounds in 6 weeks and have kept it off. I have no medications to take. I'm doing great. I love it.
Wow. So, Ed, let me just ask you, you eat no bread, virtually no bread, no potato? I'm sorry, it's John.
I gave up bread a long time ago, especially after reading Dr. Williams' Wheat Belly.
Mm-hmm. The Wheat Belly book that Dr. Mullen mentioned earlier. So
I lost about 5 inches off my gut in that 6 week period, too, with no exercise.
Wow. John, what are you having for dinner tonight?
I will have about a 5 ounce slab of ribeye and sweet potato. And what I call a chopped salad.
Okay. That sounds good to me. Thank you for that story. This is interesting because he said he's 75.
Yes, I was going to say, he's older.
He's older, and he's on the other end of this research, which indicates, yeah, go for it. That's probably going to enhance your life.
His
at this
high
point.
Protein, yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Irina in Baltimore, our next caller, joining us on Midday. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I put my family on a Paleolithic diet. We have two young children, and my husband and I have a history of cancer, and we also have a history of heart disease and diabetes in our families.
Mm-hmm.
And as a nurse, I felt like we needed to turn that around. So what I decided to do was to really look into this, and I think one of the points that I wanted to make was that the Paleolithic diet, it helped us in all the ways that your other guests have mentioned. And I wanted to say that it's not necessarily a high-protein diet. Some people consider it actually a high-fat diet, but it's really an adequate protein diet. And the fats that we utilize are fats like avocado oil and avocados, absolutely no refined seed oils. And we use omega-3s. We eat a lot of fish, but we also do eat, you know, we eat the skin on our chicken and we eat the fat on our red meat. And we've had all the same success that your other guests have mentioned, like cardiac markers improving, as well as the improvements in weight. You know, we've all lost weight. And I want to say that this has been great for my kids. They've adopted it well.
Hmm.
It's a little difficult on a social standpoint, but you know, we let them have some leeway.
Irina, thank you very much for that. I'm glad she described what she means by fats, because the earlier caller from Cockeysville, John,
right,
mentioned fats as well.
Right.
So when you hear the word fat, people say, well, you're eating a lot of fat. That's not good.
Well, about 100 years ago, they've done studies from collected serum specimens that we've, you know, analyzed. I wouldn't say we, but, you know, it has been analyzed and showed that the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 in our membranes was balanced at about 1:1. And omega-3s are those anti-inflammatory type fats that we find in the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then the omega-6 has a mix of pro- and anti-inflammatory fats, but mainly pro-inflammatory fats that you find in corn oil and in red meat that's not grass-fed. Today, the ratio presently is 20:1. Of pro-inflammatory fats in our system.
Wow.
So clearly that's, and we have most of our diseases are inflammatory in nature, including obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular disease and cancer. So we're in a day and age where we're very much out of balance.
Yeah.
And yes, if you can get the omega-3 rich, like the olive oil and the avocado and fish, you're much better off.
Patty in Baltimore with a question for our guests. You're on Midday.
Hey there. Hope you all are doing great. So my question is, I'd love to hear your guest's opinion on the ideal protein diet, if you're familiar with that. I just started it less than 2 weeks ago. I've already lost 10 pounds, which seems a little fast.
Okay.
But my sister did it for 5 months, lost 50 pounds, and has kept it off for about a year and is just eating healthier than ever before, and her family's eating healthier, a lot more vegetables. And if anyone needs a quick high-level overview of what it involves, I'm happy to share that. But basically, in the beginning, you're eating, it's low carb, low calorie, low fat. The first phase is until you reach your goal weight, and you're basically getting rid of all carbs except those found naturally in vegetables. No dairy, no nuts, no legumes. It's lean proteins and 2 cups of vegetables. So a lean protein, 2 cups of veggies, and unlimited lettuce with your lunch and dinner. And then I have a shake for breakfast and a little snack bar.
Okay, Patty, hold on now. So this actually has a this is a brand name, Ideal. It's not like, what is your idea of the ideal amount of protein in a diet? There's actually an ideal protein diet that Patty's describing. How did that sound to you, just based on what she said, Dr. Mall?
The name didn't sound ideal.
You mean the description didn't sound ideal?
Well, yeah, it's not ideal for overall health. I mean, because as we know, I mean, a high protein diet may in some put them at risk for kidney disease. Those who are particularly diabetics who are susceptible to kidney disease or have already established kidney disease, the high protein diets, particularly that higher protein diet, is not healthy either. And then even, you know, ketogenesis, which happens when you spare yourself of carbohydrates, that was some of the premise of the Atkins diet, was
right,
to put yourself in a state of ketosis. And although for people with seizure disorders, ketosis can be therapeutic, but overall, that may not be the overall best thing for your health if you're in a state of acidosis. So what she's describing is a very, very high protein diet, which will certainly help her lose weight because of the satiety aspects of protein, the way the energy metabolism is and trying to break it down through thermogenesis. you're going to lose a lot of weight, but I don't think the effects of it on your body are ideal.
Angie?
And I was going to say, you know, when I think the word diet, I think about, did I eat that? And what I mean by that is, you know, how long can you really sustain it? We really need to find really a lifestyle that works for us individually. I know a diet is not cookie cutter. Everybody doesn't eat the same thing. But if we know we can have really a base of what is healthy for us, more of those fruits and vegetables, and work in healthy oils and work in lean protein, I think that's ideal. You can keep for a long time. Common weight loss is only 1 to 2 pounds a week. We know if you lose 1 to 2 pounds a week, you can lose it and keep it off. When we do drastic things, it's a guarantee. It's not a guarantee that the weight may come back. So it's not quite ideal for me either.
Angie and Dr. Mullen, let me read a couple of emails that came in. Marilyn in Severna Park says, I get frustrated listening to studies referring to protein intake because they do not discriminate between healthy grass-fed protein versus unhealthy conventional-fed feedlot animals. These are two completely different animals. Actually, the study we cited did note a difference between animal proteins generally.
Yes.
And
Non-animal
proteins,
but
right?
not the ones that were grass-fed and raised well versus not.
It didn't get into that kind of distinction.
That's difficult to do, and right. Someone has to fund that. That's correct.
Yeah, David in Towson says, "I'm a 55 years old and went on the Eat to Live plan, Dr. Joel Fuhrman, after my cholesterol hit 277. It is basically a vegan diet with no meat, dairy, wheat, or sugar. My doctor wanted to put me on statins, but I asked for a few months to give the plan a try. In 2 months, I lost 18 pounds while eating constantly and without exercise, and I saw my total cholesterol reduced to 177 from 277. I have backtracked a bit, but I am a believer that low protein, low fat, and minimal sugar will maximize health."
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I think you're always hungry on that particular diet, and again, it's all about balance.
Yeah. Does your guest have an opinion of restricting or skipping meals once or twice per week? What do you think about that, Dr. Mullen?
There are studies on those who actually skipped versus had breakfast and looked at their hunger mechanisms later on in the day. And, of course, those who skipped breakfast ate the most at night and tend to gain more weight.
Angie, is that your experience too?
Yes, and, you know, even the studies that have been shown from the evidence analysis library has shown that people that lose weight, they eat about 4 to 5 times out of the day, and breakfast consumers have a lower BMI than breakfast skippers. So it's important for you to eat your meals, and skipping is not good because you always overeat, and you always choose bad items usually most of the time.
Yeah. We're about out of time here, aren't we? Oh, unfortunately, boy, we got a lot more questions that came in. And maybe I'll pass these along to Angie,
yeah,
Dr.
Sure.
Mullen, if you have a chance to respond to these. We'll forward these emails to our guests today. Angela Ginn-Meadow, food and nutrition expert, spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics based here in Baltimore. Angela, I'm glad you could be with us again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on the show again. And Dr. Gerard Mullen, his book from 2011 is The Inside Tract, Your Good Gut Guide to Great Digestive Health. He's a digestive health expert based at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Nice to have you back on the show with us too, Dr. Mullen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It was very informative, and I appreciated this, and gave us some ideas and some reminders about healthy eating. Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in for our midday for today. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.